whatever it was, he certainly was much more skilled in physical things. He was a Talmud. Rabbi Mark tells about that when the Yeh from the first came upon Rish Lakish, it was in Rish Lakish as the bandit. And he was a very, very powerful man. And Rabbi Yochanan, he immediately recognized his potential, so he sought to win him over to condition. So, before he persuaded him, Rish Lakish demonstrated his prowess. And there was apparently a very substantial river there in Rish Lakish, bounded across it. Because he had that kind of physical ability. The minute that Rish Lakish committed himself to go study Torah with Yochanan, Yochanan had him try to jump across that same stream, and he took a running jump and he fell into the middle of the stream, couldn't do it anymore. Because Torah, my precious Kiddush, well, Torah has it. In fact, I'm giving a person a spiritual presence in a moment that, these two, that when we talk about the acronym as being two forces which take the form of a seesaw. If one is up, the other is down. So, when someone is into their bodies, when people are into their appetites and their desires, there is a commensurate loss of ability on the spiritual level to embrace what's being offered spiritually, because the person is just is obstructing the light. They themselves are occluding those arteries that bring spirituality to them by filling them with all of these kind of self-serving and self-indulgent things. If a person is only doing what's necessary to sustain themselves physically and reject self-indulgence, then they're opening themselves up to that, being able to access and to receive spiritual energy through its balance. So the minute that Rish Lakish had committed himself to something spiritual, there was a shift, made room, and immediately diminished his physical abilities. That was criticized for engaging Israel. He should have kind of left Israel alone. Instead, he sent messengers to him. As I'm basically critical of the fact that Yaakov tried to deal with Israel altogether. He should have left alone for him. But by sending messengers to Israel, in effect, he provoked all of them to come here. Get stirred up again. He used the end of it. If there's a sleeping dog, let him sleep. Don't wake him. He certainly wasn't going to do it to the right people. Even his intentions were pure, and he certainly did achieve a great deal in this meeting. But it doesn't necessarily mean that this should serve as an example of how we should approach some situations. And Chazal wanted us to know that even if it was, let's assume that it was right for Yaakov, but it's not necessarily right for us.
If it wasn't then, that was stronger than his desire to get back, we would have took this risk. What would have been so powerful to do this?
To get involved with Esau.
Yeah.
Let me just take a look for a minute. And obviously, because Yaakov felt that this meeting with Esau and his ability to somehow navigate safely through this confrontation was important to Klal Yisrael in history in dealing with Esau, so that he knew that it's not a personal thing, that this was a destiny thing. I don't tell you one thing I had said, that the pasuk describes it in the fact that when they finally met, so Yaakov walked before his family. And it says that he bowed seven times until he reached his brother. So, in a way, incident between Yitzchak and Zonenfeld had told about his Rebbe. I can't remember his Rebbe's name. He had a Rebbe who told him that in his Rebbe's youth that he lived in a city where the rabbi was a big tummim. He was a big tzaddik, a big tamachal. He was also very, tummim is a very innocent person, almost naive. And there was a Balbus in this community who was a Musser. And a Musser was one of the most feared kinds of things in Jewish community life. This is essentially a Jew who was deceitful and treacherous, who would find out things about other Jews because he was Jewish, and then would report them to the authorities and ingratiate himself with the authorities. So these Mussars became very powerful because they had the authorities would go out of their way to do all kinds of favors for the Mussar in return for the information that would then turn them on. They could enable them to prosecute Jews, imprison Jews, confiscate Jewish wealth. But the halacha is that a Musser can be secretly executed by the Jewish community. That's how dangerous they are. That even though we don't have a Sanhedrin today and we can't prosecute capital offenses, but a Musser can be put to death by the community. Anyway, there's a Musser in this community, and this Musser was very powerful. And everybody feared him. On the surface of it, he was also a religious Jew, so he would come into the show and they would give him the biggest, the choice aliyahs and the choice kibbutzim. And the rabbi had no idea that this very prominent member of the community was a Muslim. So, one day, a merchant visited the city, and in those days, the way the merchants did it, they would go into the center of the market, they would set up a booth. And they would just sell their wares. So this guy sat in the booth, and the Musser came through, was walking the market, saw the booth, walked over, and picked up one item of what he was selling, and just walked away with it, which is what he used to do. And nobody would ever come. He would walk over to any booth in the marketplace, pick up whatever he wanted, and nobody could challenge him because they were all afraid of him. And this guy didn't know who this guy was. So he screamed out, "They're making back at you, you're paying for that." And the guy just kind of sneered at him and kept walking away. So this merchant asked people in the marketplace, "Who was that man?" They told him. So he went to the rabbi and he said, "Set up under the marketplace, and one of your members of your kahila took something and refused to pay for it." So the rabbi said to him, "Shamas, here's the one called so-and-so." So the shamans who knew, the shamans wasn't naive, so he said, "Rabbi, I don't want to go there." So the rabbi said, "What do you mean you want to go there? This is your job. You're my shamans. If I tell you you're going to go, go and summon him, and he should come here." So, terrified, with no choice, he went to summon the Muslim. And he knocked out on the door, and once he came to the door and said to the rabbi, he said, "You must come to my wits." He said, "What about?" He said, "Well, my understanding that there was somebody in the marketplace today. And you took something from his booth and you didn't pay for it, and you went to complain to the rabbi." So the master said to the shamans, "Tell the rabbi that I have no intention at all to honor his man, forget it." So he went back and he said, "This Balabus he sent me to said he's not coming." So the rabbi was very puzzled. He said, "If he has to come, go back and tell him, then you must tell him I'm summoning him to the Torah, he's to come." So he said, "Please don't send me back, I can't do this." He said, "I don't understand. Why can't you join him?" So this shamans didn't want to get into it, and he went back and he said to this rabbi, he said to him, "Is he coming back here again?" So he said, "Yeah, the rabbi has insisted he must come." So he said, look, do yourself a favor. Don't come back here again, because you're likely to get hurt. So he went back and he said to the rabbi, he told me not to come back again. So the rabbi, this time, he had to understand that there was something going on, and he said to him, look, tell me what's going on. So he had no choice, and he had to tell him what was going on. So he said, okay, you go back there and tell him that if he doesn't appear instantaneously, the man to man, that he's going to lose any standing that he has in the Jewish community. I will not allow him any further honor in the Jewish community. Anyway, the shamans in the worst way, because I was afraid for his own safety, and went back and knocked on the door. And the guy said to him, I told you everything. He said, well, I have to tell you what you're doing. And he said to him, so he left. He said, we'll see. So the next time there was, shall we say, there was some honor, and the rabbi called the Musa to this very prestigious Saliyah. The rabbi walked off the bima and walked on to the Sefer Torah and ordered him up. He said, you are not going to have the Saliyah. So the Musa comes in and slapped the rabbi in the face from the whole bima and stalked out of the shul defiantly and with a threat. This is not the last that you will hear of me. So, of course, he had been humiliated in front of the congregation in a very defendant way, and he knew that he was now in disgrace. The rabbi was revered by the community. But the community knew that the rabbi was now in danger. So they never allowed him to go out alone after that. So this Chaim's Rebbe, I'm telling this Chaim's story, said, I was a young man and they had a rotation. One day it was my turn. So he said, so I accompanied the rabbi when we had to travel out of the town to some event. He said, we had traveled out of town, we left the city for a short distance, and in the distance I saw a group of horsemen. At the head of which was a Musa. He said to his friends, he says, I immediately knew that the Musa had found out that the Rebbe was going to be alone, that you know, at best was one escort, and was going to ambush the Rebbe. And I turned to the Rebbe and I said, the Rebbe, we're in grave danger. Up in the distance, there was a group of horsemen, the head of which was the man. He's waiting for us. He could get killed. So the Rebbe said, looked up, and told this young man, he said to him, you know, just keep the horse moving steadily in that direction, slowly but steadily, and don't disturb me. And he said the Rebbe bent over his head, and was, you know, kind of lost in some meditative place. And he said, and finally, he said, they approached the place where these horsemen were waiting for him. He said, and the last minute, he said, the Musa got off his horse, walked up to the Rebbe, and fell at his feet, crying. And he was pleading with the Rebbe that he should forgive him, pleading to chew this whole thing. And he said, of course, his horsemen were standing there, they were stunned about what had transpired, such a transformation. And so the rabbi embraced his fellow and promised him that he would arrange for him to chew, and that he would be reinstated in the community. So the young man said that he later on asked the rabbi what had happened. So he said, well, he said, I knew we were, it was clear we were in danger. He said, but I also asked myself, what turns a person into something so evil? Why would anybody become a Muslim? Why would anybody live kinds of influences this person must have been exposed to as a child, what kind of abuse, what kind of pain he was in, that would have shaped him this way. He said, and I began to feel deep sorrow and compassion for him. He said, there's a rule for Nanima Panimatam that the way you feel to somebody else affects the way that person feels to you. He says, when I was able to feel compassion for him, that force was so great that it turned him and it transformed him into someone who can no longer carry around that evil. So, using that story, when Yaakov was about to meet Esau, that Yaakov recognized that all he felt in his heart for Esau was deep enmity. And Yaakov knew that as long as he feels that way, that that's the way Esau was, it would just sustain Esau's feeling to him. It wasn't that he started the enmity, but in as much as that's what he felt, that it was just going to maintain Esau's hatred to him. So, as he walked towards Esau, he bowed 7 times, and the pasuk says, until he reached his brother. What I would suggest is that doesn't mean geographically until he reached his brother. But he was inside of himself. He was looking for some love, some feelings of brotherliness. And when he finally reached that feeling of brotherly love for Esau, that's when Esau broke down and ran and embraced him. Because once he had found his brother in his heart, that's when Esau found his brother in his heart. So when the pasuk says, Adish Te'adach, until he reached his brother, not telling him that, that means until he physically reached him, but sometime until he reached his brother inside of himself. So that's kind of a lesson on how we can deal with those people in our lives who are very hard for us to deal with. And we need to find some place inside of ourselves where we can feel for them, and that's when things change outside.